The following audio file was recorded on April 8th in Nashville, Tennessee by Earnhardt Productions Incorporated at a voting rights and election reform conference titled Gathering to Save Our Democracy. It has been uploaded to this site courtesy of the January 30th Coalition, an Ohio-based voting rights group which endorsed the conference. You are welcome to copy and distribute or broadcast this recording. Please also consider making a donation to Radio for All so that recordings like this one can continue to be made available.
All right, I think our video folks are ready. Now, Bob Fetrakis.
Thank you. Thank you. I ended up wearing many hats. The one I like the most may be evangelical preacher, and my daddy would be proud of that, but... I also have done journalism, and again, I ended up in journalism by default, by training. I'm a PhD in political science, which in the mainstream media means I don't know anything about politics. I wrote for Columbus Alive for many years, a weekly, till Harvey Wasserman and I were reorganized following 9/11. Essentially, we prematurely were right on everything in the 9/11 report, which meant the advertisers weren't real happy with us, but I did get a book contract out the door with three books, and now it's been extended to three more. And I am billed as Ohio's most feared muckraker, but because I'm an objective investigative journalist, I've always told the editor he's got to put I'm Ohio's only muckraker. So I'm simultaneously the most feared and the most well-liked and well-mannered. So, sometimes you'll hear, I'll say, hey, I've won 10 major journalism awards. Well, in the area of investigative journalism in Ohio, I was up against myself in many of those contests. with people like Brad and the Brad blog, and of course, Bob, who is a very strange man. He's the only... Harvey and Wasserman and I did a book called George W. Bush versus the Superpower of Peace, which one interviewer on the web called mentioned the fact that it had the feel of certain late night rantings and raves. And I was trying to figure out whether how he got that information, whether my wife Suzanne had leaked it. Bob is the only person in mainstream media that actually reviewed the book, and thankfully he liked it. But that aside, one of the things I do is I teach media and politics, and part of it has given me a perspective on politics. For example, in order to understand what happened in the election, we need to analyze what happened prior to the election with the run-up to the media. A few years back, because I come from the school of journalism, I.F. Stone, that says everything we need to know is in the public record. I've made a career out of investigative reporting based on simply reading government documents. And apparently, often, the mainstream media doesn't do this. For example, I had been working with Michael Moore when he was dealing with Fahrenheit 9/11, and I've known Michael since he was at the Flint Voice before it became the Michigan Voice many years ago back in the late 70s. But part of media coverage then, very early on, I was able to find out, of course, that our current president, the money to buy up his oil company Spectrum 7 had come from, of course, Harkin Oil, which had gotten the money from Khalid bin Mufus, the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden. How dare you make that up? Well, I got it from the Wall Street Journal. it's just that it was back in 92 they were writing about it. I actually did that whole LexisNexis search thing. Granted, it was incredible investigative reporting. It took me 5 minutes. So part of it is there's a certain amount of laziness and also a certain amount of parameters is that you don't go towards those facts. For example, anthrax. I was one of the first people to really write about anthrax, primarily because Battelle is in Ohio. You recall Battelle, they messed up the 2002 exit polls. What you may not know about Battelle, since I write about him and we have a relationship, Battelle and I, they officially refuse to comment anything Dr. Fitragis says. So we have a good long-standing relationship. Battelle is anthrax central. Read the New York Times. They're the CIA and the DIA's favorite nonprofit laboratory. They go back to the Manhattan Project. They've had numerous German spies were brought there. They have a long-standing relation. And of course, even Judith Miller, as much as I don't like her on other stories, was able to point out that's where Project Jefferson occurred and Project Clear Vision, where the anthrax went. But also recall, right after the 2001 attack on the U.S., the 9/11 attack, that somebody sent anthrax through the mail, but also sent it to the minority leaders in the Senate and sent it to the media. And there's nothing that will soften you up. I mean, somebody sent me some powder, but it turned out to be like talcum powder. Thank God I'd read a lot about anthrax when I got my letter. I called my editor up immediately going, ah, this powder. And then I'm thinking, but I could see it. If it's really good, a trillion strains per gram, eight strain silicon impregnated, I wouldn't have been able to see it. I can see this stuff and it smells really good. So, but I took it as a message. Maybe it was cheap Soviet anthrax. But somebody in this country sent anthrax, some rogue element of the government sent anthrax to our media, and there's nothing that softens up the media like some anthrax. So, also what we know about the media, I mean, we've got this look at the media, come on. The Washington Times is owned by Reverend Moon, who was identified by the New York Times as a KCIA agent back in the 1970s with the Korean CIA. So you've got a false messiah who hangs out with the Bush family, gave Bush the elder, you know, $10 million to go over there to Japan, and he also owns the UPI, the World and I. The CIA, under oath, if we look at her public records, has admitted to owning 20 to 25 newspapers in the U.S. and having assets on every major newspaper. So part of it, as we look at the media's job, in the hotly debated topic of Operation Mockingbird, did they really sink that much money in during the Cold War in order to control the media? Well, let's ask Gary Webb. Oh, I forget he's not around anymore. But those of you who follow those stories realize there is a tremendous ability by the mainstream media to discredit points of view that no matter how statistically backed, they don't like them. But in the end, we're going to win this one. We're going to win it for a variety of reasons. What I'd like to do is analyze a few things. It's number one, in analyzing what happened in Ohio, I'm going to stick to what I know about. In the run-up to the election, the coverage really wasn't that bad in the mainstream media. Probably wasn't that bad because Ken Blackwell was so bad, right? If you go, these registrations are not on 80 bond paperweight, a thick yellow cardboard required by an archaic law in Ohio prior to scanning machines. So I'll have to send them back. And they won't get them in time to re-register to vote. So that stuff was so blatant, and judges would chastise Mr. Blackwell, that a lot of the election running, a lot of the coverage running up to the election was quite good. Now, Election Day was somewhat different. Election Day, there were a lot of stories told, and there were certain stories told on the free press prior to the election that I wish would have been more covered. For example, the simple story that in Franklin County, usually 100 people lose their voting rights every year for felons. Ohio's got one of those, if you're in prison, you can't vote. If you're out, even if you're on parole, you can. In-out rule, right? Very simple story. But this year, 3,500 felons dating back, well, they weren't even actually felons, anyone indicted for a felon, and particularly anyone living in a Democratic area, lost their right to vote. Well, how did you come up with that story? I asked the Franklin County Board of Election director. I picked up the phone, and they always assume I already know, which usually I don't. And I said, Matt, how many people have you disenfranchised or canceled their voting this year? Well, 3,500. Yes, and how many did you do the previous year? Well, 100. Ken Blackwell made me do it. Okay, that's all I needed to hear, Matt. So part of it is I think we've got to directly call these people and record them, because you'll be amazed at the type of things that they say. But on election day, the story that was first covered, when I went to the polls and at 6:30 and I found lines out the door, 2-3 hour lines. I was at 8 polling places. I was with the Election Protection Coalition, a mobile legal political advisor. I said, what is wrong? This is unheard of. Why are these lines so long? So I actually went inside and counted the voting machines. And what I noticed is at my polling place, there had been 4 voting machines in the primary. Now there was 3, and one was a convertible model that I never knew existed, that you kind of, it stood up and then you broke it down into a provisional punch card voting, which, and of course, anyone who knows anything about polling places, the 90-year-old woman and her 70-year-old daughter weren't very good at breaking down the convertible machine. In the past, you'd have 4 voting machines, then you'd have a standing punch card machine next to it, which, of course, Matt Damschroeder admits to that as well. So I immediately began to try to get media interest. All the media reporters are down at the State House, so we begin to call. Who shows up? The London Times. German public television. Japanese public television. One Pacifica reporter and assorted videographers recruited by Michael Moore. So here we have visible 3-hour, 4-hour lines and missing machines. What, not one local newspaper in Ohio actually covered that. Although I went and wrote that story, and within 2 days, the Columbus Dispatch came up with at least 39 machines missing. Of course, the guy who wrote that soon was transferred to another story. John Craig. He was doing a great job there. So on one level, when you analyze the media coverage, the local media coverage, on election day, it really wasn't that bad on a local level. Toledo Blade, Diebold machines freeze up all over Toledo. Not in the suburbs primarily, but in the inner city. The Youngstown Vindicator, right? The machine records 25 million negative votes for Kerry. The Cincinnati Inquirer, you know, who their editors is saying, this is ridiculous, this is BS. There's no terrorist attack in Warren County. Come on. It's like Osama bin Laden's not in the region. So, and even in the Dispatch, of course, is the voting machines are missing. But the problem, it's sort of like the old story with the blind man and the elephant, right? The Toledo Blade's up there feeling the trunk going, a really irregular trunk. I'm not sure what it is. It's a large snake. And Cincinnati Inquirer is down there playing with the tail, going, very strange animal here. But none of them thought to do what I'm trained to do as a political scientist, is that, and all of them would conclude, well, the 15 to 20,000 votes that were turned away in Franklin County did not impact the election. And you know, the 5 or 10,000 in Toledo and the 5,000 here. At a certain point, and this is the beauty of Richard Hayes Phillips, count them up. It's the electoral, I mean, this is political science 101, right? The electoral votes are based on the state vote. That means cumulative, all the votes in Ohio. If something happens outside of Toledo, the Toledo Blade may, under the First Amendment, cover statewide politics and votes in Ohio. So part of the coverage at the local level really was quite good. It's only when we begin to get into that kind of putting the broader picture together that they seemed paralyzed. But we were successful in getting the machine story covered. That, of course, always starts out as a conspiracy. They say there's missing machines at London Times, you know. Conspiracy theorists say they're missing machines. Well, there's this thing called numbers and serial numbers on machines. There's a certain amount of machines. So what we did, and Evan Davids really did this, a Pacifica reporter, I knew if I went down, it would trigger more bells and alarms. But he went down. We got the bill of lading. We went down under a public records request and said, give us, can we have the bill of lading? We want to see, you know, how you ship these out on election day. And so we found out that, yes, by the morning of election, they had placed 2,741 machines. Of course, they had 2,866. And of course, they'll admit it, they needed at least 5,000. But they didn't have the money for them. And as Ken Blackwell says, we didn't have the money for them. Even if we had the money, they can't be trusted. That's what he told Congress. The classic catch-22. So, okay, if you know you need 5,000 machines, why do you put out 2,741? And this was easy enough, because in the public record request, when we had the hearing, what they did is they had that odd little phrase, machines placed by end of polling. Machines placed by end of polling? Exactly. What sort of statistical analysis is that? Well, we had people under oath. They came wheeling in that machine at 7:30. The poll was closed. It's like, and then the official explanations. What I love about dispatch coverage is that they do a great job of getting the official explanation, no matter how bizarre. They don't follow up. And you had Matt Damschroeder and Bill Anthony, the Democrat who's there to protect our interests. Now, the good thing is that the Dispatch only reported he was an expunged felon when they didn't want him on the city council. They conveniently left the fact that he had been in trouble as an expunged felon, and he's a very compromised individual and the chair of the Franklin County Democratic Party. But they both said, well, here's what happened. The workers waved the machines off. The machines are coming in. And I'm thinking, okay, let's think about this. These people work 2 days a year if they're lucky. One day, because you don't need as many for the primary. It's like, hey, the machines are coming in. Now get those the hell out of here. We're day labor. I don't care what the executive director, Matt Damschroeder, says. We only need 3 machines. Yeah, I know there's a long line. And they report this stuff. I mean, ONN, which is owned by the Wolf family, which owns 60% of all the ad revenue in central Ohio, and have a long relationship with the Bush, who, by the way, the Bush family is from Columbus, Buckeye Steel Casting, Samuel Bush, who, of course, helped give himself contracts during World War I, and I go by their church every day on Broad Street, St. Paul's Episcopal Church, is they had an explanation also for the famous Gehenna Ward 1B machine. You remember that. That's the loaves and bread machine where 638 people voted and miraculously the president got 4,258 votes in one of the greatest faith-based miracles of modern time. Now leave it to the Dispatch to get to the bottom of that. I'm watching ONN one day. ONN reports, the machine was fatigued. After 638 votes were cast, you know how your computer gets fatigued. Good, thank God the computer experts we consulted said someone hacked a computer into it and set that vote total. That is a much better explanation after the 638 vote. It just added another 3,000-4,000 votes to the president. Yeah, that seems totally plausible. Also, the fact that sitting at the New Faith Church, a Dominionist church that loves Ken Blackwell, it was put out well in advance, and it was unsecured. I'm sure there'd be no opportunity for a right-wing religious zealot doing the work of Lord against the evil John Kerry to simply attach his computer and set the total. That would be wrong. So we get to the bottom of that, machine fatigue. We were conspiracy theorists early on when, in fact, the Columbus Monthly, which is a suburban news publication, another corporate suburban publication, they run the weeklies and the Columbus Monthly, they put Bob Fitrakis at the end of the year in the weird and wacky. That wacky Bob Fitrakis called a public hearing and put people under oath. It's just like it was considered a good chuckle. Of course, later they were calling up going, okay, we didn't know it'd go to Congress. Okay, we're kind of, well, you do an interview with. But anyway, it was weird and wacky. is that what I had saw, I wanted evidence. So we called these public hearings on the 13th and the 15th. And what happened? It's not the mainstream media that showed up. It's the people that are here today, the documentary filmmakers. It's the Brad blogs. It was the alternative webs that drove this story. It was people like Linda Burkett who put together the videos. We have evidence. The evidence is driving this, and the mainstream media doesn't know how to deal with it because they're operating on the assumption we're the freest and fairest democracy in the world, and there's all that socialization and culturalization. I'm a political scientist. Look, we studied voter turnout in the 1980s. We came out 44th, tied with Barbados. When we did it in the 1990s, we were 49th. We beat the hell out of Botswana. But that's that scientific facts that we look at. Granted, most countries in the world don't have a democratic tradition, but to simply assume that we don't steal votes in the United States is patently absurd. Historically, we know they stole them in the 19th century. We teach history classes on Tammany Hall. We know landslide Lyndon sent in, you know, the Texas Rangers with a pistol and stole that box in Texas. We know, for God's sake, Sam Giancana controlled 13 wards in the south side of Chicago. The ultimate assumption is true. People always steal votes. In sixth grade, they steal votes for president, class president. They steal them for prom queen. God, virtually, you know, Karl Rove stole it when he became, you know, the head of the Young Republicans. Chaos reigned. If you read Bush's brain or see the video, it's exactly what Ohio was like. He already had his model from stealing the votes at the Young Republican convention. It's been ongoing for a long period of time. And again, the bizarre part we've got to break through to in the media is the story I always tell. My dad was a Teamster, and my brother worked for Hoffa's Local 337. When guys like Dominic Fats Corrada came in and took the ballot box and took it into the back room and shredded every piece of evidence and said, look, I think Jimmy the Weasel won with, what was it, 84%? People knew they were being ripped off. But now private companies with secret software can send in there. It's like the Milgram experiment when they used to shock people, the famous psychological experiment. He has a clipboard. Maybe I will shock somebody till they die. He's a technician from Diebold. It must be okay. But that's what we've got to fight here today. And let me wrap up, because again, they're going to call us conspiracy theorists. They always do. Why? Because we're dealing with facts that lead to a conclusion they do not wish to accept, and that what they're doing now is trying to rewrite history. That's what they're doing. That's why they're bringing their phony voting rights experts. That's why they're attempting to sanction me as attorney, claiming now, I love it, there was not one act of irregularity in Ohio on Election Day. I say bring it on, because I welcome the sanctions. I will wear them as a badge of honor, and it will allow us to go forward and put our evidence into the record. I dare them to sanction me. And not only that, I just happen to know that Mr. Petro's brother, William Petro, who was the former U.S. attorney in Cleveland, had to resign after leaking information to alleged organized crime figures in 1984 and was criminally convicted. And his family has questionable connections, and that I see him as nothing more than a thug that is trying to cover up the greatest theft in American history, the theft of democracy. And it will not stand. We shall prevail. That's what we're going to do. And all of you, I know, will go forward. Go forward and do what you have to do to bring these facts forward. Thank you.
According to our pre-registration information, we have 9 separate political parties, or members of 9 different parties represented in our midst. All of us, regardless of our political affiliation, owe a debt of gratitude to the two parties represented on the stage now, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party. Some of you may not know that some of our previous speakers have actually run for office in Congress, Secretary of State, as Republicans and Democrats. We are honored to have a presidential candidate on the stage now. But prior to hearing from David Cobb, we are very fortunate to have R. Lee Reitz, who is the Vice Chairman of the Libertarian National Committee. Mr. Reitz.
Thank you so much, Bernie. Although I will disagree with you to some degree, Mr. Ellis says that you owe us a debt of gratitude. I'd say, no, we owe you a debt of gratitude. Without people willing to stand up in this country and fight for what is their birthright, you'll lose it. Politicians in Washington will take it away from you, sure as shooting. And don't get me wrong, just because I'm a libertarian doesn't mean I don't like Democrats or Republicans. I like them a lot. I like them so much that I've spent the last 5 years of my life trying to give most of them an extended vacation. Of course, that hasn't worked out as I planned, but I'm not giving up. I'd like to start out with a short statement that our chairman regrets that he was not able to be with us today, and he's asked me to read this to you. Thank you to everyone who is attending this conference and to everyone across the country and around the world who is working for election reform. The conduct of our elections is critical to secure and maintain our liberty. The Libertarian Party has long advocated verifiable voting systems, ballot access reform, proportional voting, and other measures which place the political power in America where it belongs, solely in the hands of the American people. The need for renewed integrity of our electoral systems has never been greater. We are proud to be able to work with anyone who shares this goal and honored that we can be of service to help obtain it. Yours in liberty, Michael Dixon, Chair of the Libertarian Party. Michael's absolutely right when he points out we spend a lot of time trying to work within the system. A lot has been said about Ohio. I knew there were problems in Ohio before the election doors were even closed because I am the vice chair. I get a lot of correspondence from around the country. And I immediately began to get emails and correspondence from members in Ohio complaining that some of them even showed up at their polling places where their candidate's name was marked off the ballot, marked through with a black magic marker. They were told they couldn't vote for him. The same with Mr. Cobb. They say that there's no way to prove anything went wrong. I just want them to prove to me that they did it right. I just want them to prove that they did it right. For those of you that don't know anything about the Libertarian Party is a simple philosophy. It's based primarily on individual freedom and personal responsibility. The two go hand in hand. You can't be free if you're not willing to be responsible for yourself. And trust other people to be responsible. Trust other people to do what's best for them. And allow that to happen. What I see here today, more than anything else, is hope. Hope we can turn things around, that things won't always be like they are, that votes won't get thrown away, that they won't get trashed, that they won't get lost in magic voting machines that nobody knows how they work. We can't run a free country like that, folks. It's just impossible. If you're not allowed to vote for who you want to when you walk into a ballot box, you're not free. I wrote an article about 6 months ago where people were asking me to try to quantify freedom. How do we know how much freedom we have? And I opined that the best way for us to gauge how much freedom we have is by how many choices we have. Certainly, if you have no choice at all, you're not free. If you only got one choice, that's not much better than no choice. So isn't it a shame that you've got more freedom when you walk into McDonald's than you do when you walk into your ballot box? You got more freedom when you go down to buy a new car than you do when you choose the leader of the freest country in the world. It's just mind-boggling to me that there's not more people here, that this place isn't full, that people are sitting still for it and not, you know, raising up and saying, you know, why can't we get our votes counted? Why can't we vote for who we want to when we walk into a ballot box? Well, the reason in most places is ballot access. Ballot access is very stringent in a lot of states, particularly in North Carolina, where I'm from. It's the third most difficult ballot access state in the country. Only three candidates were you allowed to vote for president in North Carolina last year. Only three. Folks, more candidates ran than three in Russia. Iraq has more political parties recognized by the government than the United States of America. I mean, what sense does that? Where is the justice in that? Where is the righteousness? Where have we gone wrong? We've let it happen. So I do see hope here today. And if I can leave you with just one thing, I'm not going to take up very much time because I want to leave the bulk of the time to Mr. Cobb. But if you leave here with nothing else today, leave here with a pledge to yourself, to your neighbors, to your family, to people you don't even know, people you don't even like. But pledge that we will not rest, we will not stop until every voice is heard. Count every vote. Hear every voice. Count every vote. Let's make it happen. Thank you so much for having me.
Howdy, folks. It is such a pleasure to be here in such unpleasant circumstances. And I want to take a moment before I even begin my remarks to focus our attention. We are 40 years from that terrible tragedy in Selma. 40 years since the voting rights movement in this country, where finally we as a white supremacist racist society grappled with the reality that people of color were not allowed to cast ballots in this country. Folks, we are on the cusp of a new generation voting rights movement in this country. We have to look back at the legacy that we were given not only by the Founding Fathers, but the improvements that were necessary to perfect the Union. Let's remember this. Voting rights in this country have followed a pretty remarkable trajectory. You know who got to vote in the founding of this country? Rich white men. They're at it again. The reality is this, y'all, that the entire history of the United States of America has been a struggle by people to describe themselves as persons under law with rights that would be protected, that they could assert in court, in society, that would be recognized. And we're not done yet. We're not just gathering to save our democracy. We're gathering to create real democracy. Let's tell the truth. You know, it was really an honor for me to follow the last panel because, as the last panel said very clearly, the corporate media is manufacturing consent on a daily basis in this country. And they are definitely manufacturing consent around an outright lie in 2004. That lie is that we experienced a fair and clean election. Folks, we did not experience a fair and clean election. This election was fundamentally flawed. And I won't go through the litany of evidence that, thankfully, the organizers of this conference have already put together, and you heard most of this evidence. Isn't it interesting that this evidence was only brought to the attention of the American people, if at all, by community radio, by independent media, and by bloggers, by the internet? And here's the interesting thing. We, the people, educating ourselves and each other. Something really powerful, I think, took place around this story, and that is that the grand poobahs of media and culture and reality fell asleep on the job, if in fact, although I'm not sure if we can wake up the media, because I, as I often say, folks, it's hard to wake somebody up who's only pretending to be asleep. But while corporate media was silent, community radio stations lit up. The internet lit up. Telephone lines lit up. Man, we lit up, right? And this story would not die. And I want to take a moment to really acknowledge Bob Fitrakis specifically and all the folks in Ohio, because they did something else. They lit up our campaign lines at the Cobb Green Party headquarters election day and the following days, screaming and yelling at us for us to do something. So it was the people of Ohio who started that process, and not just Ohio, but it was true in New Mexico. It was true in Florida. It was true in North Carolina. The reality is that this story was happening all across the country. So I filed a recount in the state of Ohio. I did not file a recount in the state of Ohio to try to make John Kerry president of the United States. I did not vote for John Kerry. Let me tell you another thing. If John Kerry had been claimed the winner of Ohio and George Bush had conceded, I would have filed for a recount if there had been the reports of vote fraud, vote suppression, long lines. This was about the integrity of the process. This was always about the integrity of the process. It is still about the integrity of the process. I gotta say, folks, John Kerry did not just concede. He capitulated. He absolutely capitulated because he knew everything that you now know. He knew it that night. It is clear his campaign knew everything that we're talking about now, and he made the cynical calculation that it was more important for him to protect his membership and the ruling elite in this country than to fight for the integrity of elections in this country. Shame on John Kerry. Shame on John Kerry. Now, the thing is, y'all, elections are the infrastructure of democracy. I mean, this is arguably the most important thing that we as citizens in this country can do. Now, I'll be honest with you. I prefer direct democracy whenever possible, right? I'd like to see us move towards a system where we say, hey, here's an interesting idea. How's about whoever is actually impacted by decisions, that they actually get to participate in making those decisions? See, that'd be a real democratic culture. I got to tell you, you know, like, telling me that I get to choose between Tweedledum and Tweedledummer in order to rule me is a bit like looking at a book cover that's titled How to Get Rich. And I say, well, I wouldn't mind getting rich. I'll pick up that book and take a look at it and find out that actually what that book is telling me is how I can work my butt off to get other people rich, and then maybe I can influence them on how they spend their money. See, if we were really about democracy, we would be about the process of creating new mechanisms and institutions where the people can actually rule ourselves. I make this assertion. Yeah, you can clap for that radical idea. And democracy is a radical idea. It gets to the root of who is making the decision in this country. Because I would make this assertion. Unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are not just exercising power. They rule us. As surely as kings ruled their subjects, as surely as masters ruled their slaves, today corporate CEOs are ruling us because they are making the fundamental public policy decision in this country. They're deciding how much we're going to get paid. They decide how much poisons and toxins get poured into our air and our water and our food. They decide whether or not there's genetically mutated organisms in our food supply. They decide what our health care choices are. Folks, we are left to choose between paper and plastic at the grocery store. We get choices at Baskin and Robbins, but when it comes time to actually creating our society, we the people, hallowed as those words may be to us, we are not in control of this country, and it's time for us to start telling the truth about that and building a movement for real democracy. Now, if we're going to be serious about a real movement for democracy, we got to start with elections, because elections really are the infrastructure of that process, right? Now, if we were going to have I say we got to democratize elections in the United States of America. And probably the first place to start is, let's be explicit, voter-verified paper ballots upon which we cast our votes. But that's not enough, y'all, because we also know that we have to have confidence in the ballots that are cast, that they're counted. And in order to do that, the only way to do it is with genuine, independent, nonpartisan administration of elections. You know, like the rest of the world does? Let me tell you something. I don't want Republicans counting the ballots. And you know what I don't want? Democrats counting the ballots. And I don't want Libertarians or Greens counting the ballots either. You know, because I'm a sports fan, right? And if I go to a sporting event and I see that one of the teams competing gets to provide all of the umpires and referees, I get a little suspicious. That's kind of what we got going on now. We need to move towards genuine independent administration of our elections so that we can be confident that the ballots that we cast are actually counted. And in addition, though, we need random recounts before any election is ever certified. Because I got to tell you, you know, we demanded a recount in Ohio, and here's a newsflash for you. We never really got one. And guess what? There's still litigation going on in Ohio right now because the Cobb-Badnerik recount, we ain't giving up. We're not going to stop. Because at the very least, we will ensure that we hold J. Kenneth Blackwell's feet to the fire. So let me tell you something. The law said that they were supposed to do a random recount, 3% chosen at random. 88 counties in Ohio. We reckon that there were three of them that they were actually doing random recounts and that we can actually confirm. Let me tell you, a recount that is not done randomly and that is done in partnership with the corporate vendors who sold the questionable technology in the first place, a bit like going to a poker game, and the dealer said, I'm so glad you're here. Please break out your wallet. We've already dealt the cards, though. You know? I mean, like, let's put this into some language that a country boy like me can understand. You know, I don't know if this election was stolen or not. I'll tell you this, it was damn sure fraudulent. I don't know if it got stolen or not. I know I have no confidence in the integrity of it. But folks, that alone would not actually create real meaningful democratic elections. As important and critical as those steps are, paper ballots, independent administration of elections, and a guaranteed random recount before elections are certified. Because even still, we would be grappling with the reality that unelected and unaccountable corporate elites are framing the process. So if we really want to get serious about democratizing elections, we got to get corporate money out of politics in their entirety. Do you know that in Almost every state in this country, up to about 25 years ago, that it was expressly forbidden for corporations to make any contributions whatsoever in politics. That's a fact. So I say we need publicly funded elections in this country. We don't need to allow the very wealthy elite to control the process. You know, elections have to be more than about choosing between pre-selected, pre-screened candidates for office. You know, and the best way to do that, I'm not saying that you, look, I don't believe that my side will necessarily always win. I do know this, that if we're going to really allow every voice to be heard, that we're going to have to get big money, corporate money, out of the election process in their entirety. And if we're going to really have democratic elections where we, the people, are actually in control of our own elections, publicly funded elections is the only way to go. And isn't it interesting that they've been able to pull it off in Maine? They've been able to pull it off in Arizona. The people pulled it off in the state of Massachusetts with a statewide initiative, and the democratically controlled Massachusetts, the Democratic Party of Massachusetts, refused to fund it. Right? And in Maine, I'm so proud to say this, that they now have a former waitress and a former plumber in the Maine legislature. You know, nothing quite like having working class people actually get into office in order to actually advocate and articulate those issues that are most important to them. And then, for me, we got to change this voting system, y'all. I mean, we got a voting system now where people walk into the ballot box and they know going in that 9 times out of 10, they are having to vote against somebody that they hate the most rather than for the candidate that they want the most. This is perverse. This is outrageous. And this is eminently solvable. Imagine a voting system that instead of having to choose between and just make a mark next to one name, which is what the current system does of the 4 or 5 candidates, you get to actually be fully empowered to express your opinion by saying, well, my first choice, my second choice, my third choice. That voting system is called instant runoff voting. It is used throughout the world. They use it in the Republic of Ireland. They use it in Australia. They use it in New Zealand. And they use it in the Academy Awards. They use it majorly. Some of you sports fans, I mean, I knew about this system back when I was a little boy because I know that Major League Baseball uses this system for the most valuable player. College football uses it for the Heisman Trophy. Hell, it ought to be good enough for elections. Think of it this way, y'all. You, the voter, get to walk into the ballot box and fully express your opinion about the candidates. You eliminate the spoiler problem altogether, and you're empowered as a voter to actually express fully your opinion of all the candidates that are there by saying my first choice, my second choice, my third choice. We like to say instant runoff voting is as easy as 1, 2, 3, because all the candidate has to do, or all the voter has to do is say first choice, second choice, third choice. And it really is easy. Folks, I have literally taught this system to elementary school children and conducted elections with them, right? It is a very easy system. And the only people, once I've described this, it's really funny, the only folks who seem to not like it are incumbents, which makes it difficult because they're the ones, they're the ones who get to write the state laws on ballot access and voting system and election reform and campaign finance and so forth. So it kind of puts the pressure on us. But I'm from Texas. And the great politician Sam Rayburn once said, you know, as an elected official, when I feel the heat, I always see the light. And it occurs to me that we might need to generate a little more heat in this country around election reform. Maybe the problem has been that we've been a little too silent. Maybe the problem has been that we've been a little too damned obedient. Because you know what I know about the first generation voting rights movement is? They didn't just complain amongst themselves. They ultimately got out into their communities, into their churches, and ultimately, folks, they got out into the streets where the people in the Ukraine went. Right? That's where we need to go. I'm asking you to join this pledge with me. No more fraudulent elections. Say it with me. It'll feel good. No more fraudulent elections. One more time. No more fraudulent elections. And here's something for you, folks. You know, Bob said bring it on whenever they challenged him. This is my State Bar of Texas bar card. In the practice of law, they're always very careful about telling folks, as a lawyer, don't advocate anybody to break the law. It can get in trouble. I'm going to put this up here where these filmmakers can see this, because I want to give some legal advice here. If there is another stolen election in 2006, I advise you to go out into the streets and engage in nonviolent civil disobedience to stop. Do not let those wheels turn again. We can't let it happen, y'all. We cannot let this continue to happen. I am proud to be here today, but we have got to pledge for future conduct. Turn up the heat. Let's make it happen. Peace. Thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for sticking around past your lunch break. I'm honored.